So, Richie, what's it like to be in the minority after you've been in the majority?
Well, it's very difficult in the House of Representatives to be in the minority, largely because we adhere to a rigid set of rules, procedures. And every piece of legislation that comes to the floor of the House of Representatives is accompanied by a rule. The rule prescribes the number of amendments that can be offered, and it prescribes the amount of time that is allocated for that particular debate. The problem is that the Rules Committee, once they establish those procedures, they make very little, if any, accommodation to the minority. In the Senate, it's very different. They don't really operate under a rigid set of rules, the result of which is every Senate member, using the hold, using the threat of filibuster, using procedural blockades, they become players. The House, because we have 435 members, it's much harder for a member of the House of Representatives in the minority to get something done. So frequently you find yourself trying to figure out how you can establish an alliance of common procedure. And I would use the example that you and I have talked about earlier, just by pounding away at alternative minimum tax with Clinton, with Bush, and with Obama, I was able to get that accomplished even though I'm in the legislative minority at this time. So I had to operate outside of the rules of procedure to keep using free media and to keep the argument in front of the American people to change alternative minimum tax. So back to that original argument, the Rules Committee meets early in the day or late into the night, and they establish the rules on which the legislation can come to the floor. At one time, prior to the great civil rights upheaval, it was the Rules Committee that kept progressive civil rights legislation from coming to the floor of the House of Representatives, and it was the filibuster in the Senate that prevented it from becoming national law. And it was only an early victory with Jack Kennedy and then subsequent victories with Lyndon Johnson that broke the back of many of those who opposed civil rights
the rules,
by
guys,
using the rules.
There was a guy named Judge Smith, wasn't there?
That's exactly right.
And he said when he didn't want a rule to come out, he would say, I'm going apple picking.
He'd go apple picking. I think he was from Virginia, if I'm not mistaken.
I think you're right. Yeah.
And Lyndon Johnson, in the end, helped to break his rule.
Right. How is it working with Nancy Pelosi as Speaker as opposed to as Minority Leader? In other words, is she nicer now?
Well, I think that the Minority Leader has to always be mindful of not only cohesive policy, but they also have to be mindful of messaging. You have very few tools when you're in the minority and you're the Minority Leader. Free media is one of them. And you constantly have to have your argument succinctly made, and you have to use that argument, as she did in the sixth year of the Bush administration, to help bring us to the majority. And the other thing that Leader Pelosi does, and let's be candid and frank about it, is there isn't anybody in Congress, House or Senate, that raises money the way Nancy Pelosi does.
Mm-hmm. Let me go to another place before I lose you here, which is always too soon, and that is gun control. The president has got an ambitious package. I read a poll that said 79% of the people think there ought to be something. The House Republicans, I think, are holding their noses. Is this a trap for them?
Well, I think that we need to be mindful of all or nothing. And I think that there's a notion here that if we can't get all of what it is that we'd like to see, then we shouldn't let that become the enemy of getting something. And I don't know any of us on the Democratic side who are pursuing the argument that we want to take the guns away from legitimate sportsmen and hunters or gun collectors, but I think we could all agree on mental health background checks. I think we can all agree on closing some of the loopholes at these gun shows. And to be very frank, as you know, in 1994, I voted for that assault weapons ban. And I don't think that's an unreasonable position either. Whether or not that part of it can be accomplished, I think that's uphill. But not to miss the point that if we can't get it all done, we shouldn't say, well, we can't get anything done.
Mm-hmm. And you're somewhat optimistic about getting some of
that? I'm optimistic on the margins. I think the president's taken it up earnestly. You can see some long-time gun rights enthusiasts here, Senator Warner in Virginia, Senator Manchin in West Virginia. They've all indicated that they are now open to discussion about background checks for sure.
How did Obama do in the inaugural?
I thought it was terrific. I thought that he hit the right notes. I thought that...
Speaking of which, Beyoncé's in big trouble, according to the press, because she lip-synced. Now, that's absurd. I mean, that is just absurd. Who cares if she lip-synced?
Exactly. I mean, the amount of time that I would spend thinking about that is probably equivalent to what you've just mentioned.
The press is unbelievable sometimes. They
well,
really
the fact
are.
That it's in the New York Times and the Washington Post today surprises me. Mm-hmm. But the point is, I thought that he hit the right notes. An inaugural, as you know, is a confirmation of an election. And the pageantry that accompanies it is very important for the world as well as the American people to witness. The president outlines his views. He has the opportunity for 20 minutes, or in the case of Bill Clinton, sometimes up to 50 minutes, to talk about the priorities for the coming 4 years. He's wise enough to know he's not going to get everything that he wants, but at the same time, he serves as the architect. And then Congress serves as the construction team.
Wow. Did you enjoy it? Was it an enjoyable experience?
Yes, I enjoyed it. It was a chance for me to say hello to people that I don't always see. Right. And there were a number of notables on the stage. I had a chance to say goodbye to Leon Panetta, who's an old friend from the House, the Secretary of Defense. I said hello to Bill Clinton for a few minutes. I was surprised that Jimmy Carter showed. I thought that was nice to have him there.
Were you surprised that Mitt Romney didn't show?
I guess I was surprised. I thought that he might make an appearance. I was there the day. I've never missed one of these, Republican or Democrat, because I think it's important to be there to witness this event. And, I sat there through three Bush inaugurals, two Clinton inaugurals, saw Ronald Reagan say goodbye to the country when he left, and watched President Obama take the oath twice. And, you know, the acrimony that surrounded Bush v. Gore was on display the day that George W. Bush took the oath. And at the same time, I always thought of the special grace that Bush Sr. had offered as he stood there and watched Bill Clinton take the oath. That must not be an easy moment. And I thought that he did it with great elan.
Well, I think history is treating, you're the historian and you really are good at this, but I think history is treating Papa Bush a lot better than they're treating young George.
Well, I also think, you know, we need to be reminded he was a real scholar of the process, and he had had extensive experience as the CIA director. He had been vice president, chairman of the Republican National Committee. And he actually called me a number of times, once from Air Force One. I was in here early in the morning, and he called me to ask me for my vote on something. And when I told him it wasn't going to happen, he couldn't have been more of a gentleman. And so I think that he was a skilled political figure. And I think that the alliance that he put together to remove Saddam Hussein from Kuwait back in the early 90s was the model that should have been employed again. And I think that there are many parts of his career in terms of legacy that are noteworthy. But let me say this, George Bush Sr. was and is a very decent human being.
Well, is there three dots after that in response to my question about young George?
Well, I think that the problem that President Bush Jr. had was very simple, and that was that he embraced a philosophy that was far outside, in the end, the mainstream of the American people. The theology that you can cut taxes six times and fight two wars doesn't square with budgetary reality. And I know that the Bush family would have embraced science with a greater enthusiasm than President Bush Jr. Clearly, they came from old mainline families across Connecticut and New England, and they would have embraced science again as the path forward. And I thought that governing class that they frequently offered for Bush Sr. would have been very similar to people like Bill Weld and the Saltonstalls and the Herders and people like that in Massachusetts. We would have known them well.
Or as my mother would say, the best of their kind.
Very decent people in terms of day-to-day governance. And in fact, you know, they tended and oftentimes to be more liberal on the social issues than urban Democrats.
Sure. Well, Richie Neal, great respect to you, sir. And thank you so much for showing up and doing this. I always enjoy these conversations
really enjoy it,
so
Alan.
Much.
Thank you.
Thanks again for being there.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye.